discover, experience, repeat.
You are listening to Fly here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Melissa Rodway, and today I have Mark Quattrocci. Did I get that right, Mark?
Quattrocci, yeah, you Quattrocci. Got it.
Mark Q, we're going to call you. Mark is in the studio with me. Mark is a motivational speaker and leadership facilitator for WE organization and specifically for the WE charity. For anyone who is unfamiliar with WE, that is an organization with many different branches, all of which help to empower people making a difference through international development work, donations to programs for children and communities, and so much more. So the big story here today is that in 2014, Mark left his life as a teacher in southern China to ride back to his home country of Canada. This was a journey that took over 2 years, covered 35,000 kilometers, 40 countries, and 5 continents. Mark has written a book called The Cycle of Life and the Power of Saying Hello. He has now spoken to over 75,000 people at hundreds of events, not only about his journey, but also about the power of sustainable change. Mark is also the recipient of the Paul Delaney Award for Outstanding Young Philanthropist. He is a TED Talk speaker, but most importantly, Mark is now a dad. So Mark, welcome to Fly.
Thank you so much, Melissa. It's so great to be on the show.
This is a big, lengthy title and introduction that we did for you. It's quite an accomplishment.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you sharing all that.
Yeah, it was a mouthful. So, Mark, this book was written, The Cycle of Life and the Power of Saying Hello, but it's still not available to listeners at this point because you're still shopping around for a publisher. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. It has been written for a little bit, but right now I'm just looking for the right home for the title.
Right on. So if anyone is a publisher listening to this story, you might want to jump on this tale. So before we get into this amazing 2-year cycle journey, let's delve into your past a little bit, your past life. So you are from a town in Ontario. I've never heard of it. Rideau Ferry. Where is that?
It is a small town between Kingston and in Ottawa. The kind of place, there's no, you know, population on the sign. It gets busier in the summer. It's on the water. It's on the lake. Really beautiful, really pretty, and just the place I really still do call home.
And you were born and raised there?
Yeah, absolutely.
So is that where you developed a sense of adventure, or what was your life like there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, growing up, I spent a lot of my childhood riding my bicycle around like the back roads, the dirt roads, to friends' houses here and there, and just really getting to explore nature at its best. On the weekends, we go out in the morning, and sometimes we come back at night, you know, maybe with a couple of scrapes and bruises, but me and my brother and friends in the surrounding area, we would just, you know, go out and have a great time.
Yeah, those are the good old days, eh? I'm from a small town as well, and I love those days where you just like ride your bike and the streetlights dictate when you come home, and
absolutely,
it's fun. Yeah,
so good.
And how do you think growing up in a smaller town helped you to get to where you are now? You're speaking to so many people, you're doing all these public speaking events.
Yeah, it definitely helped in many different ways. Just for example, the people that I got to interact with every day, driving down the dirt road where my family lived, like everyone just waved at each other.
Yeah.
Everyone knew each other. And so I think that made me more open to meeting people on a regular basis, which is one of the best parts of traveling.
Yeah.
Also for many people, probably one of the scarier parts, just meeting people. And I always felt very comfortable around, maybe it's my small townness, I don't know, but just being able to walk up to someone, say hello, and being comfortable to start that conversation.
So you did a lot of traveling even before this massive trip that we're going to talk about. So you taught ESL in various countries. What was that experience all about?
Absolutely. So I taught English in South Korea for 1 year. I found I really loved to teach. It was a really great experience. So I came back. I went back to the Trent University where I got my undergrad and I did my Bachelor of Education. And then I knew I did want to go back overseas again. I really loved that experience, be able to travel, to work. And I got a job at an international school teaching Alberta curriculum to kids all over the world from all different backgrounds. It was in China, in the southern China, and it was an awesome experience. And from there, I got to do incredible trips to places like Mongolia, to Laos, to Myanmar. I did motorcycle trips through many different countries and really got to experience some of these countries that you don't normally hear about. Like, I was super interested to go to Bangladesh, for example. And being in China, in southern China specifically, it was a jumping off point to lots of amazing places like Philippines to all over Southeast Asia.
That's nice. Yeah, it was great. Nice part of the world. Yeah. Where did this dream come from? You were living in southern China. Where did the light bulb go off that this was something you had to do, was to ride back to Canada?
So the light bulb went off actually about 6 years before that. And so I was in university, I was going to school, and I was honestly reading a book about someone that did a bicycle trip around the world. And I was like, wow, that's a thing? I didn't know that you can even do that. I didn't know that is how some people even traveled. I did a bit more reading, a bit more research, and actually later that day, after I finished reading the book, I wrote down that I'm going to ride a bike around the world one day.
Wow.
I actually didn't believe I was going to maybe do it for real. I just kind of wrote it down. But in that moment, like, a seed was planted. And not long after that, I really did catch the travel bug. I got to do an archaeology dig in Belize, digging up the history of the Maya, which was incredible. And camping in the jungle for 5 weeks and getting a credit for it was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And so I really did have the travel bug at that point. And I felt like I wanted to be able to connect my love for seeing places throughout the world with making a difference in some way. And so when I got the job teaching in China, I knew that was the point where it needed to start. Because
mm-hmm.
If not then I was just going to push it to the next year, and it was never going to happen. So I got a 2-year contract, and I kind of knew as soon as I did get it that I was going to be leaving at the end. I didn't really tell anyone at that point because who's going to hire you? But this was something I knew I had to do. And love teaching. It was an incredible opportunity, and I wouldn't trade that for the world. But always in the back of my mind, I knew I had to do this. I had to do this for myself.
Where were you in China? What province were you in?
I was in a place called Hainan. It's in southern China. So I was in a city called Sanya, which is one of the southernmost places in China. It's beautiful tropical island. They call it Chinese Hawaii, and it's truly just like the winter getaway for many people that are in the northern part of China or even places of Russia and different parts of northern Asia that really just want to escape winter or just go for a nice little holiday.
So during that 2-year contract, did you start planning this big expedition?
Absolutely. Definitely a year out was serious planning. I had already started to tell people at that point that this was something I was doing. The more people I told, the more I was held to it, which is why I was telling people about a year out, sometimes some people about 2 years before that, you know, around the time that I did get the job. And so I felt like, you know, the more people I tell, the more likely I'm going to do it held to it. Because I was obviously a bit nervous of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Can I handle this? I know I've done travel before. How does it look on a bicycle? I never really done anything like that.
Had you traveled by bike in the past? Were you a cycle traveler?
I had done no bicycle traveling. I had done a bit of motorcycle traveling, which is a lot different. I did trips through Mongolia, Laos, and China.
Yeah.
I had a little scooter in South Korea, and I owned my motorcycle in China. But I always felt on those trips like there was something missing. I always felt like it was really difficult to connect with people on those trips. There was that privilege, that barrier, flashy motorcycle. Even though it wasn't probably a nice motorcycle that I did have, it was always that barrier. And I always felt it was a little bit too easy.
Yeah.
If I'm being honest, in some respects.
There is something nice about being out in the open air with people, right? Either if you're walking or biking, and you're kind of more in it, I think.
Absolutely. And I think it's a very humbling way to travel.
Yeah.
You really earn every inch of the road ahead. And you're right there with all the people. You're biking beside people sometimes. You know, you're not just racing past. You hear all the noises that are going on around you. It's really, you're on the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you determine what countries you were going to go through? You went through 40 countries.
Yeah. So originally I had had a route planned. So, I mean, I had a lot of time to think about this trip. I had the idea 6 years before that. I probably had my route planned like a couple months after I had the idea.
Yeah.
But I didn't know where I was going to start, kind of thing. But when I got the job in China, I really knew what my route was going to look like. I thought I knew what my route was going to look like. And so I had an original plan, but things definitely changed a lot along the way for many different reasons, from struggles with visas to just general upheaval throughout the world and different parts that changed from the time that I started the bicycle ride. And like, for example, originally I had planned to go through Syria, and unfortunately that was not the case and impossible by the time I arrived in that part of the world.
So you were kind of winging it, but you had a plan in the back of your pocket.
Definitely. Definitely winging it, you know, faking it till I made it. And really, I did have an idea where I wanted to get to, and like, I always have like a pinpoint marker and kind of those waypoints that kind of like guided me towards those next destinations.
Yeah. So 40 countries, we're not going to go through all 40 of them, but you have a top 10 list that you wrote about in your manuscript. So let's talk about a few of these. So on your list, you have Kyrgyzstan, Bolivia, South Africa, Sudan, Peru, Macedonia, India, Lesotho, Paraguay, China, and Afghanistan as the bonus country. So why of the 40 are these the countries that spoke to you?
All those countries spoke to me for many different reasons. I really enjoyed those specific countries for different reasons. A lot of it had to do with the people that I was meeting there. And I often found the places I was going through that I knew the least about, it seemed, were actually the kindest, some of the most welcoming, some of the most incredible people that I had met ever while I was traveling, specifically, for example, in Sudan and in Afghanistan, were the most welcoming people on my entire journey, which absolutely blew me away.
Yeah.
And other countries I love, for example, for like the food, like delicious food, like in India or Mexico and those types of places. So I like different countries for different reasons in many ways. And it really is dictated by my personal experiences. And really, I do like getting off the beaten track. And in many ways, those countries are not on the typical tourist trail,
yeah.
Which really allowed me to see parts of the world that you don't normally see on someone's fancy Instagram feed or something like that, or on a typical Nat Geo, a show or something. So it really gave me an opportunity to explore the world the way that I wanted to see it.
Yeah. And I love that you said Afghanistan is addictive.
Yes.
That's interesting.
It is in many ways. I went in, if I'm being honest, with a very I had stereotypes in my mind, of course, of what I might see when I crossed over that border.
Well, you can thank the media for that.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. And it actually ended up, as I said, being one of the kindest countries of my entire trip. And the more I got to see, the more I loved the beautiful mountains, the amazing food, just seeing the history, but also the incredible resilience of an amazing people that really did take me in and to show me their homes, their culture, when they really had no reason to. And it really, really did stick out to me as the place that I would love to go back to, as a place that I wish we heard in the news for all the right reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But historically, unfortunately, for the last number of years, many years actually, a couple decades, has not been the most positive of stories, when actually, for me, my experience there was quite positive.
That's amazing. Well, thank you for sharing that. People need to hear that. So that's great. What kind of challenges do you encounter on a trip like this? I'm sure they are numerous.
It depended on where I was.
Yeah.
But lots of different challenges for sure. In the beginning of my trip, I would say the majority of my challenges were me not knowing what the hell I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so not being in bicycle shape. I mean, I definitely didn't train enough for the trip. I did relatively no training, which was, I mean, you can say what you will about that. But it was a 2-year trip, and I always told people I'll get in shape on the road. And the first day, I biked up that mountain. And then the second day, I couldn't get out of bed. So the first couple months was definitely physical, and honestly, learning a lot about what to do when something goes wrong with the bicycle.
Yeah.
Because I was on my own. There was no support vehicle. There was nothing like that. I didn't want that, and no one was interested in giving the support vehicle, but there was definitely some instances where something would go wrong. I'm stranded on the side of the road. You got to figure it out. And it always seemed someone would either come to my rescue, or I'd like work my way out of it, be creative. And the more I traveled, the more creative I got.
But
near the end of the trip, it was definitely mental. Being able to finish what I started, knowing how routes would unfold, just seeing a line on a map and knowing that it's going to be a mountain, and you're going to have to be biking uphill most of the day, or waking up in your tent and knowing that you're going to be going into a headwind all day long, was very, very challenging. And it was really a lot of mental resilience that allowed. I did have very bad days, but it took some time to get through those days. And you know, sometimes I just had to stop.
Yeah.
And collect myself, but it really taught me a lot about myself.
Did you take a lot of rest days? Would you ever take a month out and just relax for a bit?
Not really. I was kind of going for most of the trip.
Yeah.
People did come to visit me. They didn't bike with me. I had family, my parents, my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, come to visit me in different parts around the world, but it wasn't for long. They can only get so much time away. And also, I found the more time I was off, the harder it was to get back on the bicycle, especially if you're seeing people that you love and people that you miss. So it was better just to keep going. In some cases, I did like to stop and like see a couple sights here and there, take a break, rest my legs, and eat a lot of delicious food. But majority of the time, I try to keep that momentum.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. And so along the way, you built 5 schoolhouses.
Yes.
Let's hear about that.
So I didn't build them physically with my hands. But I went to visit the communities I was fundraising for with WE. I was fundraising on the journey for these communities along the way, one in China, India, Kenya, Ecuador, and Nicaragua. And through the sustainable development model of the WE organization, which now I currently work for WE. And so I was fundraising to help build these schoolhouses. As a teacher, I was passionate about access to education. And I wanted to see these communities as well and like actually volunteer and help out and also share with my supporters online who were fundraising to help build these schools. So that was like the biggest thing that kept me moving in many ways. And some of the more challenging days, knowing that there was something bigger than me just, you know, spinning my tires and like taking photos. There was something bigger behind it. And the further I went, the more I felt attached to this cause that I could see. It was tangible. It was there. It was happening. So,
yeah. Yeah. So you did help build the schools.
Yes.
How long would that take?
Depended on the project.
Yeah.
And it really depended on when I could get the funds. And so it really was dependent on a number of different factors, as well as like what projects were currently happening in the communities where we were working, and where the need was.
How did you do the fundraising, like while you were cycling?
The fundraising was all online.
Okay.
It was all online through a donation page. So I didn't have to handle any money myself, which was great. And so a lot of it was actually schools in Ontario, schools in North America, as well as friends and family, people that had heard of my journey. I had spoke at some schools along the way about my trip. So it was a collection of incredible people throughout the world that felt some sort of connection to my bike ride, felt some sort of connection to education and making a change for young people to go to school throughout the world.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I love reading your manuscript. I have read a little bit of it. I haven't read it all, but you're a very, very good writer. And I think what I like the most about it is you're very honest. You have some very honest emotions about this kind of journey, because I think for people who don't travel or they're not adventurous, they always hear these stories and they just think that everyone is loaded with confidence 24/7 and that there's never a shadow of doubt anywhere. But you're pretty honest. And I loved the description you wrote about the first day where you were like, what am I doing? Why can't I just be normal like other people? And I have had that also, that feeling sometimes where you're like, you get yourself into a situation, you're like, why can't I just be watching Netflix at home and be a normal person who goes to work every day? So I love that you're really honest about that. So can you speak to us a little bit about what it was like for you setting out on this journey on the first few days or weeks and adapting to what you had signed up for?
Absolutely. And yeah, thank you for your nice words. I appreciate that. And those first few days were honestly, in many ways, sheer hell. And so I really thought I had bit off way more than I could chew. I was so thankful there was no one near me that could see me.
Yeah.
and my agony and like my regret of like, can I do this? Is this going to happen? And so, as I mentioned in the beginning, I was on this island of Hainan, and I originally thought I'd get across it in, like 4 days. Like, that was my plan. I was going to shoot across this island, then I was going to take the boat to the mainland and start the journey across China, which I knew was going to be a huge undertaking. Starting in China, it was no easy feat. I knew that I wasn't naive to that. But the first, instead of, 4 days, it took me about over a week. I had to, wait to be able to get onto the boat because I was so sore. I had this horrible pain happening in my knee. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know if I'm cut out for this.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I said, it did get a bit easier. But there were a lot of setbacks in the beginning. And there was a transition from being this teacher person to now just going out on this bike ride. And now this is my life. And it was a lot of mental at that time too.
Yeah.
Why did I leave such a good job?
Yeah.
That was so comfortable. They were going to give you more money. Why are you now putting yourself through this? Is this really worth it? And I think I was missing a lot of what was actually going on around me at that time because I was so preoccupied with myself. I was so preoccupied with what I had bitten off. And originally I thought the thing was going to take around 3 years. So I was like, is this me? I've done travel before, but is this who I actually am? And I had to do a lot of thinking. I did a lot of journaling on this trip to actually sort through those pieces. And then after a few weeks, I really started to connect with the people that were around me, and that's really when the trip changed.
Mm-hmm.
When I really started to be in the moment, instead of looking at the map and thinking I've only gone a little inch on this map and I've been biking for a month, I started to see it day by day.
Mm-hmm.
And see the beauty that was around me, and stopping for those moments, really saying hello to people, which really allowed me to connect with people on a different level, and ultimately opened up the conversation to be able to get to really see the people for who they were and in the culture in which I actually wanted to ride this bicycle around the world in the first place for. I really want to meet the people that I was traveling past. And so it wasn't about just taking photos and of all these big sites around the world. It was actually just meeting people and hearing their stories. And the bicycle was that open invitation that mm-hmm. allowed me to begin to do that once I was smart enough to stop thinking about what was me? I'm tired, I'm sick, I'm feeling sick, or I'm sweaty, and all the things that were actually not really that wrong, but felt wrong at the time, and getting to know the people that were around me.
Mm-hmm.
And being welcomed to people's homes throughout the world, because after that point, it was over 250 times where people went out of their way to help me.
Wow.
Which I thought should be the opposite in many ways, considering some of the countries that I was traveling through. And I didn't have a huge budget. I was living off less than $10 a day, camping most days, cooking my own meals. And so I had my own struggles as well, but I also knew that I was traveling through places throughout the world that were struggling through lack of access to water, lack of access to food. And so it was coming into people's lives from a place of being humble, but also wanting to learn. Yeah.
I love that people embraced you and took you into their homes and helped you along the way. People are people everywhere you go, and they want you to be safe and to be okay.
Yeah, and I think it's that if anyone came to visit Canada,
mm-hmm.
I think you'd want to show them the best of our country, the best of Canada, and what Canada is to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just a bit of pride and being able to see someone coming to your country and willing to see it in a different way, whether they think your way is the right way or not on a bicycle. I think a lot of people were just surprised and curious the further I got away from the main tourist trail.
And so were you mainly in rural areas?
Sometimes I had to go to cities. I needed to get, like, I would honestly usually avoid the cities if I could. And so, I mean, I did bike into the biggest, most populous city in the world, Chongqing, China. I biked through Mumbai, India. I cycled into Nairobi, some of these massive cities throughout the world. And usually wasn't my favorite part, but usually I needed either to get some supplies, like bicycle parts, stock up on certain foods that I was missing, or just even I have a night in a decent bed in a hostel that I found was a decent price or something like that. Or maybe I was also invited by someone along the way I got a friend of a friend of a friend. You can stay at their house in this city. But most of the time I was in rural areas. That way I could camp easily. Mm-hmm. I would always, if I could, if there was someone around, always ask someone if I could camp. And that was a really cool opportunity to meet someone. And everyone always said yes. I was mainly traveling in kind of the countryside, the mountainous areas, the hillier areas. And those are the areas that I actually love. And, you know, I felt like just at peace to be able to bike around and not be hustling through a big city.
So did you eventually find that feeling of freedom and happiness once you had made the transition?
Absolutely. It did, as I said, take a tiny bit.
Yeah.
And of course I had setbacks and depended on the place I was traveling through, but I absolutely found that peace, that tranquility, and that, like, that flow that allowed me to navigate with open eyes in the country that I was traveling through, and to be willing and open to going down the road I didn't intend to go down, like actually metaphorically and actually in person, literally, to being willing to shoot down that dirt road and knowing that this is probably going to be another cool adventure.
Yeah.
Or, you know, sometimes you heard of, like, that big site that you had to see, or everyone's telling you need to go see this thing, but maybe that's actually not the thing that's right for me.
Totally.
In this moment.
Yes.
Maybe I don't need to be at this site, because after traveling long enough, I knew that didn't make
speak
me much
happier.
My happiest moments on the bike ride were just meeting people and hearing their stories, and or just getting to sit with people and laugh, and or just be with them where they laughed at me while I cooked my dinner or something. I don't know. Those are like the happiest moments.
Yeah.
Or just sitting quietly on the side of a mountain after a big climb.
Nice.
Yeah.
And 40 countries, how many languages do you speak?
So I speak one language well, I think, English, pretty well.
So,
But I spent a number, 2 years in China. My wife has Chinese background. She's from China. So my Chinese used to be a lot better. You know, I think it's okay. My wife would probably say it's awful. She would definitely say it's awful. but enough to get around. I spent a long time in Spanish-speaking countries. My Spanish used to be pretty good. Now, if I haven't used it as often as I would like, so unfortunately not as good as I would like anymore. But at the time when I was on the bicycle ride, it was quite good. By the time I reached, for example, Mexico, after going through over around a dozen countries that speak Spanish aside from Brazil. So
yeah, I love that part of the world. It's the most fun, I think.
Yeah, definitely a lot of fun. Really beautiful. Yeah.
And were there many people out cycling like you were? Did you hook up with any cyclists along the way?
Definitely. I don't claim to be like this only person that's doing like this type of travel. There are a lot of people doing cycle tours throughout the world. And it is its own little community. It's its own like niche of travel. It's not for everyone. I wouldn't recommend bicycle travel for everyone. You have to know yourself and know that there's going to be some really tough days and being able to handle that. But there was a number of different people. I met up with a father and son, for example, in Malawi, in Central East Africa. They were on a tandem bicycle, which was really cool. We rode together through parts of Malawi, which was awesome, and Tanzania. Actually, I met them in Tanzania, into Malawi. And I met up with random other people just passing, going the other direction. And also a French cyclist. We cycled together for a bit in Ecuador and Colombia. But it always seemed like everyone had their own route, had their own thing going on. And ultimately, I knew I liked to travel on my own. And so it was good to catch up and, you know, someone to share dinner with some nights, or find a really cool camping spot, share stories from the road. But this was an individual solo journey. And, you know, I also did become a little bit set in my ways as well. I'll admit that. And so traveling alone was the best for me, I found, because I could meet people every day through my own way.
Yeah.
But Yeah, it was cool to see other people out on the road doing their own adventures and like just hearing kind of like what's up ahead.
Yeah.
And kind of sharing some stories, just sitting on the side of the road and chatting.
What are border crossings like when you're traveling by bike?
You get some raised eyebrows from the it's not the typical mode of transportation that people are, you know, going across a border on, depending on the part of the world you're in. But pretty straightforward. You know, you wait in line like everyone else, and then you come to the gate or wherever you need to go. You present your passport, and as long as everything's in order, you're going on through. You know, people telling you good luck. Depends on where you are. But most people are super friendly at the border. I never had any issues in terms of, like, border crossing challenges or, like, someone asking for a bribe. There was a kind of an awkward situation in Kyrgyzstan where a guy was, like, alluding to it. But I, you know, I was like, nah.
Yeah. Move on.
Yeah. So, other than that, there was no real challenges, actually.
Did you have any dangers or sickness or anything like that?
Definitely dangerous. The most dangerous part about riding a bike around the world is the traffic. And so people are not used to, in some countries, people on the road on a bicycle, which was very scary. I got hit by a truck in Greece. It's actually an ice cream truck.
Well, that's a nice truck.
Yeah. Exactly. The guy stopped to make sure I was okay.
Did he give you ice cream?
There was no ice cream.
Oh, come on.
That's like the worst part of that story.
Yeah, terrible.
Actually, so inconsiderate. The guy did help me out. I was in an accident. So that was like definitely a challenge, definitely shook me up. That was a point where I thought I was in my flow. I thought I knew what was going on. I thought I was in like this, you know, this kind of like meditative cycle state where you're just like, you get on the road, you kind of like a routine in many ways. And I could cycle for days and feel great. But then that was a point where I really did kind of want to quit. And really question, is this worth my life? So then there was no other point even going through more of the, what you quote, dangerous parts of the world. There was no feeling. I never had that feeling before. Like, oh, this could actually, I could maybe not make it home. So that was definitely a turning point. And I got through it. But it did take some time afterwards to be able to, like, confidently get back on that bicycle every day. And just, like, kind of, like, cowering as every car would go past you after until you kind of regain that confidence. But other than that, I mean, sickness, I was only sick. Well, I, of course, had sore throats and coughs and stuff like that, but like actually sick two times in the 2 years, which I think is pretty good. I ate as healthy as I could and I sweat a lot every day. So I think the exercise kept the sickness at bay.
Yeah.
But like dehydration in India, it was
the worst. Yeah.
It's like 40 degrees out and I'm shivering with a sweater on. You're quite sick. And so a bit of a rough go there with that one, but also very sick in Ethiopia. Either ate something or I had malaria. I'm still not quite sure. I did take malaria anti-medicine to get over it because nothing else was working. So I was never diagnosed, but I felt the worst feeling I've ever felt.
Were you in the hospital for any of these occurrences?
I had to go to the hospital for sure, for both, and also seeing like what healthcare was like throughout the world. And I know we complain here in Canada, but I really was appreciative of our healthcare system in many ways. But I did get as best care as could have been provided, and the medicine I did need. It was a bit of a scary time for sure, too. But again, recovered.
Yeah.
And I knew going into the trip, I mean, something like this, I could get sick.
Yeah.
I could get hurt. You can't predict everything. So,
yeah.
I mean.
How did you keep your mental health so strong? I mean, obviously, you're mentioning there are days when you're questioning it. You know, it's hard to do what you're doing. But how did you fight through that?
For my mental health, a lot of it was having little goals. I originally started the trip with big goals, like thinking I need to get to this city, you know, and that's all I would think about. And when any setback, anything go wrong, then you're feeling like a bit deflated and it's harder to keep going when you don't make whatever you thought was like your own personal deadline or whatever it was. And so I would celebrate the little things, the little victories, just like if it was especially a specifically hard day, where the wind was blowing really hard, and instead of going about 20 kilometers an hour, I was probably cycling at 5 and feeling like I was going nowhere. I would think, okay, I'm going to bike for an hour. and then I'm going to stop and I'm going to eat a snack. And then just really enjoy that snack.
Yeah, being in the moment.
Being in the moment and knowing that this is just one day. It was definitely very hard sometimes, depending on the situation. When you're soaking wet or getting snowed on and your tire goes flat and those types of things. But it's just really enjoying the little moments. For example, like honestly, just like eating like a Snickers bar, even though it's like frozen solid, or just like a hot cup of coffee or tea or something like that. Especially on like those harder days, it really makes you appreciate what you do have and what you do need. And also just for me, journaling at night, being able to like kind of take stock of what had happened that day and being like blown away by all the things that did happen that day, because it's easy to forget when so much is coming at you on a regular basis, and problem solving and those types of things. Yeah.
There's another really amazing part of your story in your manuscript, because you talk about dreams. So I think I personally also feel like this, that we're all starting to revisit the things that speak to us or how we felt when we were younger about adventure. And we're starting to question, you know, all these bucket list items that we think we're supposed to have. So let's talk a little bit about chasing our dreams and why it's important to make them a part of our lives.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot to be said for how important dreams are to us. And I feel sometimes we don't give them enough credit. I feel we think that, oh, it's just a dream. I had that when I was a kid. But that dream is there for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
That I mean, that's a past part of you, but that's actually who you are. And that kind of defined you as a person at one point in your life, and there's a reason for that. So I think there is point and purpose to visiting those types of things. And it may not look the same way as you envisioned it. I know this is kind of vague, but like it may not look the same way as you envisioned it at the original point, but maybe it's pulling pieces of that out into your daily life. I mean, we all have like that job we wanted to be when we were a kid, but why did that fade away? And why did that change? How did we change? And so it's actually bringing those past pieces of ourselves into our current, you know, our current life, our current jobs, our family, and sharing that. I think one of the challenging parts with dreams is we don't share them with people. We keep them locked away for ourselves, so mm-hmm. like a secret. Mm-hmm. It's like our little secret. We don't tell people what we actually want to do. And I think the turning point for me in actually doing the trip was actually telling people about it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something I really wanted to do. And I couldn't always explain it, why I had to do it. I knew I like this part of this trip. I like this part of this trip. I like photos. I like writing. I like all these things. But actually all those pieces of who I was actually turned into one big thing, from writing, from photography, to education, to just simple travel, and also challenging travel, really all kind of came together. So it wasn't just like one thing, but I think all dreams have merit, all dreams have purpose, and I think we don't give them enough credit. And it's not to say everyone needs to quit their job and go travel, because that's not everyone's dream. It's finding what makes you you and the best version of yourself.
And you wrote about the fact that dreams are not always easy, right? If it was easy, then we'd all be ticking these dreams off like every day. But they're challenging sometimes.
Absolutely. I think if a dream was easy, then, you know, as I said, like as you mentioned, we'd just be checking off our dreams every day.
Mm-hmm.
Like it would just be like, oh, done, to-do list, dream mm-hmm. done. They're there because they're called a dream. They're called a goal for a reason.
Yeah.
And they involve a lot of hard work. But I think they're one of the most worthwhile things of pursuing. And it doesn't happen overnight. And if you talk to any, you know, big business leaders, those types of things, and if you ask them, what was your big turning point? Or like, what was your aha moment? There is no aha moment. It is actually just general hard work, the day-to-day.
Yeah.
Like, when did you know that you discovered this? Like, it was actually a series of events. It was a series of days. It was a series of hard work and putting in the time. And it's not glamorous, actually.
No.
A lot of it, what you call living your dreams, you know, some people look like miserable when they're living their dreams, but actually they're like, it's a higher goal. It's a higher purpose than just the one day experience.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and what we were saying earlier is, like, I think sometimes people think that every day is rainbows and butterflies when you're pursuing a dream, and it's not always. Sometimes it's really hard, but, you know, life is hard no matter what you're doing.
Exactly. Life is hard no matter what you're doing, but it's knowing that there's a purpose behind it that counts. And there will be setbacks, but it's knowing that, you know, you have that end goal in mind. And even when you have that end goal, it's honestly like when I did finish the bicycle ride, it was like the next chapter was beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you have a great next chapter. So you're this big motivational speaker now. Let's talk about that. What's that life like for you?
So it's really great for me. yeah. So, I mean, I do work for the WE organization as a speaker and leadership facilitator, which takes me to all over the place, especially around the Toronto area, speaking in schools. And it's been an amazing journey and another journey in itself. And I was never and what I would call a gifted speaker, but that, again, that took time, that took practice, and it wasn't something that was actually natural to me. It did take time to kind of develop those skills, and I'm still developing those skills. It allows me to share this story and the incredible work that we were doing through the WE organization in countries around the world, but allows me to do that on a daily basis and to get my story out there and to share my messages around like following those dreams and pursuing the passions that you have in life and the positive change we can create through that.
And you talk a lot about our interaction with others and developing community. And so you had many observations over the last 2 years of your journey there. So what can you say about the importance of you know, human kindness to each other and your observations out there in the world?
I think that, especially, I would say, in North America, we're very, very friendly, but we're a hard cookie to crack. Mm-hmm. I think if we don't know someone and we're, you know, on the subway, we're, you know, on a bus, we're just like even just sitting beside someone at like a sports event, it's hard to go deep in terms of like getting to know someone in that situation. It's really like all the weather, all what's going on around us, and not so much like going a bit further than that. And I think that we have an incredible opportunity every day that we're missing out on. I mean, my bicycle ride allowed me to, and it enforced me in many ways to meet people. I mean, at first I was like, okay, I need to meet people. But later on, I was like, I get to meet people. Mm-hmm. And I'm so excited to see where I'm going to end up at the end of this day and who I'm going to meet, because I never knew. And some of the greatest moments of like human connection were actually the ones I really did not expect. Mm-hmm. Just someone stopping on the side of the road in like somewhere like Zimbabwe and saying, what are you doing? Where are you going? Can I help? Mm. My house is down that way. Do you want to come for dinner? It's knowing that that person is genuine. And after meeting enough people, I can tell when someone was being genuine and actually wanting to help, wanting to get to know me, or just curious and about someone else. So I think it's coming at a place of like, oh, I actually want to meet this person, not like, oh, I have to meet this person, I'm at this event.
Yeah,
And so I think human kindness is a huge opportunity, and honestly something that's going to bring us all closer together. It shouldn't divide us through borders. Canada is an incredibly multicultural country, and I think that we have an opportunity to learn about people throughout the world, right here in our own city. You don't need to travel around the world to meet people, mm-hmm. From all walks of life, from all histories and backgrounds and amazing stories. And so I think it's just a matter of having that confidence and knowing which questions to ask and how to get the most out of every experience.
Yeah. And is that what you talk about in your motivational talks?
I talk a lot about, yeah, like just empowering people. Mm-hmm. I recently put out a TEDx talk called Cycling Around the World and the Power of Hello. So just simply that one is my own work in terms of like taking that message. And that was, I mean, with a TED talk, it's sharing like one message, one clear message. You have like 10 minutes. And if I could share anything, it would be to share that, you know, we are, as you said before, we are all just people. People are not some story in the news. They're not some sort of statistic. People are actually people, and they all have their own stories. And so that's kind of what I share through my regular talks is stories. Stories from my road experiences, stories from the road, yeah. And how we can create positive change, yeah.
I love that, the power of hello, because it's so simple, right?
It
just saying hello to somebody.
Yeah, it's actually, my message is actually, I found it like I did this big, long journey. It was just like, say hello. Yeah. Like, if you could boil the whole trip down to like two words, say hello, mm-hmm. Which is, I think, I needed to do the trip to be able to figure that out. And I think everyone has to go on their own journey with it in many ways. I would say it's not like, oh, like now you can just, you don't need to travel. You don't need to do this. Like you need to also do your own journey in whatever way that looks for you. But it really was quite simple, the message I wanted to share in the end. Yeah.
You can say hello in 40 languages. That's impressive.
I don't know. The different countries have, you know, like some of the, I don't know if I could say 40.
Just say that you can. Yeah. It's good. So I have this visual of you, you know, riding for all these, well, 2 years is a pretty long time, right? 40 countries, 35,000 kilometers, 5 continents. What was it like when you rode home? Did you ride into your hometown?
Yep.
Wow. How emotional.
That was, I'd be lying if I said I didn't cry, but, it was kind of like a slow homecoming in many ways. Even in the parts of the United States, I was kind of like meeting old friends from past lives, like people like that I had met in South Korea, hadn't moved back home and those types of things. So I was kind of going from person to person, and that really started at actually the border in Mexico. I crossed the border and met up some friends from when we were teaching overseas and stayed with them for a day or two. But when I did cross the border into Canada, it really did feel like I was home in many ways. I crossed from Detroit into Windsor and then rode in towards Toronto, and I was kind of like family member to family member. I have a big Italian background family, so everyone was opening up their doors, which was awesome. But then the last day, I met everyone in Rideau Ferry, as you said at the beginning, where I'm from. I met everyone at the very end. It was probably about 40 of us or so, like maybe 30, 40, I'm not sure exactly how many, 50 people. We rode the last 5 kilometers together.
Amazing.
And everyone was there, and it was actually, I'm thinking about it now, it's like really, really quite emotional.
Yeah. Nice.
It's because a lot of those people had supported me on the trip, they had followed me, or just like cheered me on in some way.
Yeah.
That was really, really special. And so like that last moment was really cool in many different ways. So really, really special.
Yeah.
But also like a testament to like, okay, now this is done.
Yeah.
Like, this feels like it's done. This feels like it's done. I had like my emotional moment, and I also like, you know, got to meet everyone again, and it felt like it was kind of like starting over in some way.
And so you've been living in Canada ever since?
Yep. So the bike trip ended about 3 years ago, and so kind of got to working on the book soon after that. And ultimately, you know, I hadn't worked in two years. I needed to go back to work. And so I've been living in Canada ever since then. I got a job as a teacher for a little bit after I got back. And then I got the opportunity to share my story to a wider audience on a regular basis. So I've been working with, as I mentioned before, working with WE ever since then, sharing my story, sharing the incredible work we were able to do through the organization. And they continue to do every single day. So now it's like that next chapter, and happily, you know, now married, new daughter, an 11-month-old girl named Amelia. And this is like the next big chapter of like, you know, fatherhood and life in Canada.
And Eliza, that's your wife's name.
Eliza? Yes, Eliza. Yeah. Her Chinese name is Yi Ying. She stuck with me through the whole trip.
Amazing.
Yes, she's way stronger than I am some ways, in many ways, and really is the backbone of that journey in so many more ways than one, and really knows more about my trip than anyone.
I'm sure.
From the tough days, from the days I wanted to quit, she was the person that was always encouraging me forward. Even when she knew, like, I just want to be with you. Like we just want to be together, you know, and like, but it was something bigger, and she knew I had to do it.
She knew you had to do it, yeah.
Or I would always regret it, and maybe she saw something there that I didn't even see. So, yeah.
Amazing too, with technology now, right? That you can keep in touch with people on a journey like that.
That was huge. I think if I had done the trip 10 years ago, even, I think it would have been that much harder.
Oh yeah.
To be able to even just stay connected with Eliza, I mean, I could easily get internet access throughout the world. and connect with home. It wasn't like I was looking for some old dusty payphone in some like border town or something
writing
like that.
A letter.
Literally being able to get access to internet everywhere. Like, yeah, I wasn't calling home or writing. I did write letters. I did
I still
wrote letters because I thought they were cool and I could buy neat stamps and like,
yeah.
You know, send to Lisa, send to my family and those types of things. And those are something, you know, that you always keep, right? So it's nice to get a letter.
Yeah. Still. And so what are your next big dreams? What are your goals? I mean, so, besides being, you know, a dad and a husband.
Yes, dad and husband are like priority 100%. And yeah, being a great husband and dad as best I can. But also, you know, being able to share my message, whether it's like the power of hello or just encouraging people to follow their dreams or know that they can create a positive change in the world. And it doesn't need to be big things, doesn't need to be bike around the world. It's definitely not for everyone. But I was also being able to share that message and through my book. So that's something that I'm working towards. That's been another chapter on its own and a whole other learning experience.
Yes.
And a really positive one. And again, also one with ups and downs and that ebb and flow of like trying to get that message out there and get it into the hands of someone and the people that really get it and understand that message. And I think I'm in a very good place with that right now to get it out there hopefully quite soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this book that will come out hopefully sooner rather than later is again called The Cycle of Life and the Power of Saying Hello. That's the book title.
Yeah, that's the book title.
It's amazing. So we hope to see that on the bookshelves very soon. And we've been speaking with Mark Quattrocci.
Yeah.
There we go. He's been here in the studio with me here on Fly at CIUT 89.5 FM. Do you have anywhere where people can look at photos or anything of your journey?
Absolutely. You can find a lot of my photos on Instagram. My name, Mark Quattrocci. Mark with a K, and Quattrocci has two T's and two C's. and not very many of me out there, so you can find me. Mark Quattrocci on Instagram, lots of photos, especially if you scroll a bit further down. A lot of photos of my daughter at the moment. But if you scroll a little bit further down, a lot of photos of travel through incredible places throughout the world. I still do share some photos. But also on Facebook, LinkedIn, those types of things. Same thing, Mark Quattrocci or Quattrocci Mark.
And again, I was saying to Mark before we started that you're a really good writer. And what I liked about your manuscript, too, was it's not just the story. There's like little life lessons in there. And I really appreciated that. So within the story, there's, you know, a lot people can get from this book. There's great messages. There's, you know, like little segments about parts of the world and things to do and see and eat and countries that you liked. So it's a pretty cool book. It's there's a lot in there.
Thank you. Yeah.
Maybe I should be your publicist.
Love that.
We'll leave it at that. Okay, Mark, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it, Melissa. It's been fun.
You are listening to Fly here on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Fly.